Hello, everyone. This is Emily Kalaszewski, Membership Engagement Specialist at the League, and I want to thank you for joining another important webinar today on the COVID-19 pandemic. Today's webinar focuses on the topic of leading in a crisis with special guest and Harvard professor Stephen Goldsmith. Leadership skills are never more important than in an emergency such as a coronavirus pandemic we are currently experiencing. In this webinar, Professor Goldsmith will share some of the best ways to harness leadership in times of crisis. He'll also highlight how to use technology to create a more responsive government that engenders citizen trust. We reached out to Professor Goldsmith after we were inspired by his recent article on this topic in Governing Magazine, and we want to sincerely thank him for accepting our invitation to speak to our members on this incredibly important topic. A few notes before we get started. Following the presentation, I will be facilitating a Q&A session with you participants out there. To submit questions, please type them in the chat box on the upper left side of your screen. And now let me formally introduce our speaker today. Stephen Goldsmith is the Daniel Paul Professor of the Practice of Government and the Director of the Innovations in American Government Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He currently directs Data Smart City Solutions, a project to highlight local government efforts to use new technologies that connect breakthroughs in the use of big data analytics with community input to reshape the relationship between government and citizen. He previously served as Deputy Mayor of New York and Mayor of Indianapolis, where he earned a reputation as one of the country's leaders in public-private partnerships, competition, and privatization. Stephen was also the Chief Domestic Policy Advisor to the George W. Bush campaign in 2000, the Chair of the Corporation for National and Community Service, and the District Attorney for Marion County, Indiana from 1979 to 1990. He's also the author of a number of books. So thank you, Stephen. I'll turn it over to you to begin.
Thanks very much. So let me just, is the audio okay? Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can. I can hear you just fine.
So thanks for the introduction and good to be with you. Let me just, as you could tell from the introduction, I'm a local official masquerading as a Harvard professor, right? I've been at Harvard for some time, but I still view myself as a local official. I was in local government for, 30 years, city, county, and otherwise, and then over to work for Mayor Bloomberg as a deputy mayor. But I also come before you humbly because I handle my share of tornadoes and hurricanes and floods and the like, but never anything as serious as the situation you all are facing. So I'm just going to talk for 15 or 20 minutes about kind of some somewhat general theories about how one thinks about leading in a crisis. But I do want to start with my disclaimer of appreciation for what you're going through today. I did, back when I was deputy mayor, the emergency management reported to me, among other things. And I would go into and New York City had a reputation as particularly professional emergency management for kind of obvious reasons, given the number of emergencies and disasters that occur. But I'd go into that group and I'd try to ask them a question about some disaster that might occur. And they would, they're a very professional group, but they would always take out like a three-ring binder and say, well, I'm glad you asked that. Here's how we're going to handle that. I'm glad you asked that. Here's how we're going to handle that. But what was always kind of in the back of my mind was, we're not able to imagine every disaster. So how do we, right? We don't have a three-ring notebook prepared for what we don't know about. So how do we think about creating how do we not only lead in a crisis, but lead before a crisis that prepares us? So let's just step through these slides quickly. Let me make sure that I can do this. Do I have control of this? I can't quite. I'm not. Would you move to the next slide or give me control? But I'm not sure if it's me or you. So I just want to start with a few slides that kind of state the obvious that you're feeling. But these are from a Gallup poll that was commissioned by a nonprofit called Strata Foundation. Just to kind of, we'll go through these really quickly just to paint the picture that you all feel. This is the percent of Americans have either lost their jobs or had their income reduced. And just in the last week, that's gone from 46 to 61%, maybe a little more severe in Michigan. I'm not actually sure, but these are national figures. Next slide, please. So the I'm not. Yeah, thanks. And then this is I mean, you can just feel this in your day-to-day work, but it's just really worth thinking about it. Just in a week's time, we've gone from 50%, 57% of the people worried to 70% of the people worried. Next slide, please. This is just to kind of paint the picture that you see, but statistically. And what's really interesting, right, many of us who've worked in cities for a long time obviously give attention to those who are more impoverished or in more stressful communities or the like. But what's interesting about this is that the concerns are pretty even and about the effects of COVID-19 across all education categories. So it's very evenly distributed in a not very very good way, right? Next slide, please. We're about through with these, but I just think they're. And then what's also not directly in the hands of local government, but well, it deals with the level of anxiety you feel, right, is that a fair number of Americans are not just looking to go back to their last job, right? They feel more vulnerable and they're trying to figure out where they go for education or training. So that's a third of them. And then let's go through the get to the rest of the deck here. Next slide, please. I don't know why I can't manage it. If you look at just the headline, those who believe they need more education, 64% of those think they need more education or training would go look for a different job. Next slide, please. And the next slide. So now let me just, I'm going to go to some COVID issues in a second, but let me frame the conversation the following way. So this slide serves two purposes. One is to pitch a book I wrote, which you should all run out and buy, called The New OS for Cities. But it's also to say that as we think about the response to the COVID crisis and we think about government going forward, we really need a new operating system for government, right? We need an operating system. Just pay attention, if you would, for a second to the four blocks. We need one that's more oriented around the user, right? The resident or the public employee. We need one that acts more in time, right? How do we get away from pieces of paper? How do we use Internet of Things data, right? How do we respond more quickly? How do we process permits more quickly? We need problem-solving public servants, right? Many of us, particularly in these kind of advanced civil service states like Michigan, you know, has a reputation of a very advanced career civil service. But that also means that too often we have our public servants operating in routines, right? They inspect restaurant one, then in restaurant two, then in restaurant three, or fire department goes to building one, then building two, but building three is part of its fire inspections, or fill in the blank. Yet how do we give the public servant the data he or she needs to target the outliers? Next slide, please. Move your mouse inside the screen box. Somebody's giving me a clue here. Screen box. Trying to see. Okay, maybe this will do it. So as we think about this, thank you very much for the clue. The old system was task-based and reactive, right? The new system uses data to be predictive. And this is the same too is true in the way we look at resources to respond to the virus or not, right? So we're looking at how to create a system that looks at the outliers, targets resources to the outliers, you know, doesn't rely on multiple sequential handoffs of pieces of paper, doesn't look just at routines, looks at the way we can identify work across agencies. Just a couple observations. These were in that governing article that was mentioned in the introduction, which is that what is leadership in a sense of crisis, right? Well, the most important thing a leader can do is give confidence to his or her residents, whether the leader is in an agency or is the mayor or not, right? That when one speaks, particularly a mayor or a county executive has the ability to kind of command a media presence. But how do we paint a narrative that uses reliable data, but also incorporates the community in that conversation? So one of the key features of a leader is calling the public together in a way that creates understanding of the need, right? So how do we communicate regularly and transparently and accurately and concisely? Another element of leadership is how do we use imagination and nuance to drive a response? And finally, you know, how do we pay attention to particularly vulnerable populations? Now, this is from Oakland, I just pulled it out. There's a lot of interesting examples throughout many of your communities, cities, and states. But communication requires more than words, right? It requires maps. It requires tables, because people react to narratives when they can visualize those narratives. Almost everybody on the call today has an open data site on their local government. But open data is not really open data until it's well visualized, because open data that's not well visualized is really not clear. So in a crisis, what do those dashboards look like? And importantly, as we tell the story in a crisis, people kind of understand, but they really understand when they can place that problem in their neighborhood or in their county or their city. So providing context for data, you know, that many of you click daily, probably like hundreds of millions of other folks, on the Johns Hopkins maps that allow you to look at anything in the world, but also click on your city, right? So I just put up some of the maps. The Michigan State Police data dashboard, I thought, was an interesting map. This is one from Cincinnati that allows one to see the COVID crisis by sex or age in Cincinnati, a heat map in Detroit. These are all ways of building the narrative, building understanding. And if you think about it, the most important thing a leader can do during this time of crisis is use her words in order to cause the residents of the city to change their behaviors in a healthier way, right? So, and then one way to do that is to say, look, this problem is real, and this this is one way to visualize it. And this is, people care about what's near them. This is a Baltimore, so one way is to kind of show folks concern so they change their behavior. Another way is to say to them, we're going to help you solve the problems collectively as a community. We're going to help solve the problems. This is just a Baltimore map that shows food distribution sites, grocery services for seniors, and the like, just as a way to present the resources. Then I think one of the most interesting things going on around the country, and I just grabbed a couple examples, is how local officials are, right? So one of the interesting things about a crisis is that your city attorney is not coming in any longer and saying, here are the seven things you can't do, right? He or she are coming in and saying, here's what you can do. You need to stretch your authority, mayor. You need to be providing just the whole idea of telling people to stay at home, right, is kind of an interesting kind of exercise of authority. So how do we use imagination to create services where we didn't have those services before? So if the schools are closed, as you all are dealing with, where do healthcare workers and police officers and firefighters go for their childcare services and the like, right? Where do folks go for mobile food pantry, because the food pantries have been staffed by senior citizens who don't want to go to the food pantries anymore because they're scared, right? So how do we induce imagination, if you will, in the way we respond? And how do we bring folks together to think about where are those areas, right? When the legal pause in evictions is over with, how do we intervene and protect folks who are going to be unfortunately vulnerable from evictions, right? How do we expedite and assist the small businesses in applying for financial assistance? How do we map and identify where older isolated adults are and whether they need special services? What I'm trying to do here is just say that the most important, in addition to this, the most important feature of responding to a crisis is building the narrative that inspires confidence and changes behaviors. And the second is to look imaginatively at problems that can be solved and how do you redeploy your employees. And, you know, and these are just more examples of thinking in a clever way about what rules do you want to suspend, what rules do you want to enact. The bookmobile on the right is no longer a bookmobile. It's a free Wi-Fi truck, for example. I had a meeting yesterday with chief data officers from 25 large cities. They're trying to, one of the big issues here, it's more difficult for mid and small size cities than it is for, you know, Detroit or maybe even Lansing, but is to say, you know, where does data help us make decisions? There's some data that these chief data officers are talking about from an organization called SafeGraph that lets them see anonymized movement of cell phone data in their cities so they can understand where folks are moving around, not in real time, but just looking at kind of the intensity of of local action. Many of you and many folks around the country are trying to look at PPE availability and burn rates. Many of you are using data to project absenteeism and readiness in police services, healthcare, fire departments, you know, based on illness. So the next big issue after imagination and narrative is data. How do we use data to inform the decisions that we're making? I'm about finished. And then this is just a kind of, this is an article I just wrote for Governing. It's not out yet, but I was trying to think about the following. So I think government is really good at pushing the switch on the left. You know, government's open, government's closed. Your store is open, your store is closed. But what if we thought about rheostat government and not on-off switch government? What would that look like, right? So maybe these are just ideas. I'm not advocating, but, you know, we have local building codes. We have state building codes. We have occupancy requirements in terms of restaurants and venues. Maybe the issue isn't whether we're off or on. It's kind of how that dimmer switch is turned on or off, depending on kind of how much occupancy would the venues allow. Maybe the restaurant inspectors are not looking just at what they inspected before. Maybe they're looking at whether the restaurant complies with a set of COVID virus best health practices in terms of what occupancy is allowed in that restaurant, right? Why are we asking police officers to touch driver's licenses when they can scan the back? Why are we asking people to touch parking meters when we can use payment apps and stored value cards? Trying to think of ways that imaginative leadership can look at reducing the opportunities for contagion as we come back on. So the last slide, and happy to take your questions. I know you're all really busy. Is the following? Dan Baltz wrote an article a really long article in the Washington Post last Sunday. It's first of several. Just pointing out, this wasn't really directed at local government, but it was directed at kind of the question of why weren't we prepared for a major crisis? And of course, no one could have been prepared for this particular crisis, but we could have been more agile in our response, obviously. Not at the local level. That wasn't a comment about the local level. But maybe as we think about our governance, right, we need to think about resiliency. You know, what is resiliency? It's not a three-ring notebook. How do we create professionals that listen to their community and watch the data to identify matters in advance? How do we reward employee discretion? So what if there is an employee in one of our agencies that sees some data that looks strange, how do we give her the confidence to sound off even if her supervisor doesn't agree? And then lastly, I mean, one of the challenges, I think, for local government and, of course, federal and state government is we operate inside these agencies. But risk doesn't confine itself to an agency, and people don't live in an agency. So understanding trade-offs across the agencies, right? So what happens when stores are closed? What are the trade-offs of those? So thinking about this in the future about ways to nominate the trade-offs, I think, is important as well. So it's been good to be with you. The book on the left was the one I referenced. The one on the right's not out yet, but it deals with kind of mapping as forms of collaboration. You all are in the most important jobs in America at the most important time in the last century. Your ability to use your personal dedication and professionalism to make people's lives better or a little less worse, depending on what circumstance you're in, are really quite important. And I appreciate you spending some time with me. Thanks very much.
Excellent. Thank you, Stephen. I do have a handful of questions to ask you at this time. So starting us out, is crisis a needed precursor for real innovation to happen at the local government level?
That is a great question. So I think crisis produces innovation in unusual, catalyzes innovation in unusual ways. I've spent the last quarter century either trying to innovate or teaching about innovation. And just, you know, so I could give you about a 10-hour answer, which probably wouldn't be appropriate. So let me just confine it this way. So, no, it's not necessary, but it is necessary to have something in your cities that stimulates innovation, right? It could be an innovation delivery team made up of one person. That's what I did in Indianapolis. I had a two-person team, and they were just designed to kind of go get the data and say, and challenge the way we did business. There is a tendency. So if you're a mayor and you appoint your agency's directors and their agency directors are all, loyal to you in the professional sense, right? But soon they become captive of the information flows in their agency. So you just need a better way to kind of capture information for purposes of a friendly way of challenging the way we do things. That could be data, that could be through data, that could be through another person. So it's not required. So what is required is imagination, and what's required is an additional source of information, and what's required is somebody who helps carry out innovate. So you can have tactical innovations inside the agencies, right? That's the job of the commissioner or secretary or whatever the title would be, director. But to have cross-agency innovation needs a sponsor and a champion. And then finally, as whoever asked the question clearly knows, and the champion needs to protect those who try to innovate in good faith and fail. The mayor or the elected official needs to inoculate them and insulate them from blowback.
So, tapping into that imagination piece a little bit more, in times of cognitive overload, how do we tap into imagination at all levels of our organizations?
Well, trying to figure out which stories to use. So when I went to New York for Mike Bloomberg, which is a great opportunity, I thought I was more or less taking the job of chief innovation officer, and I was actually taking the job of kind of deputy mayor of operations, which is more like chief operating officer, not exactly. And I thought I could do both, but I couldn't do both, right? Because it's very difficult to manage the day-to-day crises, which there are plenty of those, and to manage innovation. So I think what we, and, but the other problem is, if you think about this, you can get mired down in the day-to-day. I've used this story about the deputy mayor of New York, Linda Gibbs, who's in charge of social services, and she used to be in charge of homelessness. And the question is kind of, what is the public value you're trying to create? And the definition of public value is what really why we're all involved in this call today and why we're in local and county government, right? So she went to the office one day and she said to the folks who worked for her in the homeless department, kind of, what is, how do we define performance? What's progress? And they said the number of folks for whom we find shelter beds, right? That providing shelter for the homeless. She looked at them and said, well, hold it a second. That's the definition of failure. The definition of value is when we prevent homelessness, not when we need to provide shelter beds when we fail. That's definitely part of what we're doing. Our job should be to prevent homelessness, right? So you can think about this in a way that says, let's step back. Somebody has to step back and say, the last kind of anecdote. Mike Bloomberg measured everything, and I used to watch it, everything, and I was responsible for kind of those performance report cards when I was there, and I looked at what we measured, and I finally realized that, a lot of the stuff we measured were just activities, and those activities really didn't produce more of the performance. So I think what the answer to your question is, step back, challenge the activities we're doing. Does a unit of activity produce a unit of outcome? And if it doesn't, we should turn it on its head or do something differently.
So, along those same lines, how do we get buy-in from other city officials when coming up with creative ideas to inform citizens and keep them safe when more imaginative ideas may ruffle a few feathers?
Well, so there's this great quote from Machiavelli. I wish I would have put it in my slide deck. I'm going to intentionally not quote it correctly, but it basically says that the people who are against change know who they are, and they're really against it. And the people who will benefit from the change don't know who they are, and if they knew who they were, they wouldn't believe you anyway, right? So you've got a mismatch between stakeholders opposed and stakeholders for. And so part of the goal here, right, is to, A, inside government, make sure that there's a champion to protect the person who nominates an idea, to make sure they don't have to go through all the levels of bureaucracy to get to the top. And the second is to think very, very clearly So when you pick an idea that is an innovative idea and is going to ruffle some feathers, then go through an exercise that says, who are the stakeholders? Why would they be for or against? What would make them a little less against? What would make them a little bit more for? Who's going to manage that message and who's going to manage that group of stakeholders? And then take it on. So that you know, like when we were doing some of the more aggressive stuff in Indianapolis, you know, we went first to the unions and said to them, look, we need to do a better job here. We want you to be our partners. And so part of the partnership is we're going to agree that no matter how efficient we become, no matter what we do, we're not going to, no union worker will lose his or her job. We may retrain them. We'll work with you to do all that, but nobody's going to lose their job. We want to create an environment of trust so that we could produce some of the more innovative ideas.
Shifting to a staff perspective, how would one provide inspiration to their workforce in a way that speaks to the spectrum of anxiety that they're feeling? And can you offer any ideas about how to thank and inspire employees for coming to work without necessarily, associating a large cost with that?
So look, unsurprisingly, people work in government because they want to help somebody. They don't go to work in government because they want to be rich, right? They go to work in government. But then what happens over time is that they often get involved in commodity work where maybe they're not actually talking to a resident. Maybe they're, you know, processing a file, and they begin to lose the connection, right? So they're motivated by helping someone, but they don't actually see what they're doing as helping someone. So anything and if we just stick with the use of data for a second, so to the extent that we're using data, I mean, think about this in the simplest way, right? So that you've got a small call center, to the extent to which you use an IVR in the front of the call center, and the calls that are routine get diverted somewhere else, and the people who are manning the call centers can actually help somebody solve a problem, right? So their motivation goes up, their job satisfaction goes up. So A, recognizing that we need to get more opportunities. B, I think direct relationships between city workers and the residents helps. I mean, we have a number of people who are field workers and see residents every day, but we have a number of workers who don't. I mean, Boston a few years ago came up with an app that allowed, you know, the resident to app in a picture of the problem that needed to be resolved to the 311 center. That went to the employee that was going to fill the pothole, and that employee could then send a picture to the person who complained about the pothole, saying, you know, I'm Joe, I fixed your pothole. So I overstated it a little bit, but the goal is then to create that relationship. And then lastly, I think it's important to use every small way possible to thank people who come in, right? So, you know, the leader of the team should have lunch with the mayor, right? I used to be involved in the child support enforcement business as a district attorney, right? And we used to tie balloons on the desks of folks who had done something great for some mom who needed her child support. It could be, you know, tickets to X, Y, Z or local restaurants, but in a better time, obviously. So I think anything I don't think it takes money, right? Money's great. People like money. One year I gave bonuses to the solid waste workers because they had so much increased their productivity. And maybe the greatest thing I did as mayor was that Christmas when I handed those bonuses to those solid waste workers was maybe one of the most exciting moments I really had as mayor. But I think it's a bunch of little things. It doesn't have to be expensive, but it's the recognition that you've done something for your fellow resident that is particularly motivating.
All right, so diving in on data a little bit further, which is better, data-driven or data-informed?
Whoever asks that's way too sophisticated. I'm not sure I want to answer that question. So, look, let me answer it differently. What we don't want to do is advocate the use of data. What we want to do is advocate how we can solve a problem through the use of data. So when Chicago started its really deepening of the use of data, this must have been 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, I can't remember. And one of the first problems they took on was rats, right? Or were rats, I'm not sure which, because they'd gone to the agencies and said, what problem do you have that we might be able to help you solve? And so it turned out that the people in the rat patrol wanted to know what would predict a rat infestation, right? So they went to get the data, lights and complaints and types of trash barrels, et cetera. It's obviously a very small example, but it was the use of data to help solve that problem. So, and if you think about it, what government often does is react to problems. If somebody complains about X, Y, and Z and you go solve it, but we could actually use the data to preempt the problem or identify the problem in advance. So I think that data, and this doesn't all have to be complicated data science. It can be what I call kind of query, right? So what if I did this? What if I did that? Where is where is this problem most concentrated in our community? Where, what age group is most negatively affected by this policy, whatever? So I think data informed is great, is probably the best way to think about it, but also using the data to paint pictures and narratives that move public behavior is important as well.
So I think we just have the professor for a few more minutes, so I might be able to get through one or two more questions. Whenever we begin to return to normal, or whatever the new normal may be, are there particular approaches we should use to communicate with our residents that help remind them of how we were able to emerge from the pandemic, share recommended responsible actions that we should all continue to be taking to not regress, but do so in a way that doesn't scare them and provides them with hope that we can continue to move forward from the challenges we're facing today?
Yeah, these questions are terrific. So I think this may be the most important question of the day, and one I'm embarrassed I didn't address. So I was chairman of AmeriCorps and Vista on 9/11, and the president announced relatively suddenly that he wanted to create a site for any American who wanted to volunteer to find the best volunteer opportunity near them, right? We built that really quickly, and it was designed for kind of local use. But at any rate, what happened was a huge resurgence, if that's the right word, of civic spirit. And so I think that locally generated campaigns, right? So it's not just we're your big brother, we're going to tell you how to act. It's kind of like, let's come together in Muskegon, right? Let's come together in whatever our city is here. And maybe it's painted with a picture on the website. Maybe it's the mayor's speech. Maybe it's saying, okay, here's what we're going to do, right? As a city, we're not going to shake hands. As a city, we're not going to touch these things. As a city, we're going to look out for is our neighbor a shut-in and needs more help, right? So what are the set of things that we should do together? But it's a celebration of civic spirit, right? It's not a kind of like we're going to increase our enforcement over your day-to-day behaviors. It's let's come together so that we can return to normal more quickly and in a safe way. And I think leading that sort of campaign would be a wonderful thing because, you know, that people in crises want to help. But this is a very confusing crisis because you can't go out in the street and volunteer, right? Because you're not supposed to go out, right? You can't go to the homeless shelter yet because it's kind of risky for you to serve food there. So kind of what are the steps? You know, here are 10 steps for a healthier Lansing, right? Whatever they are. And what can you do to enforce those? How can you remind your neighbor? How can you do them yourself, right? Those are the sort of things that I think would catalyze civic spirit in a really upbeat way when people are feeling pretty beat down.
Right. So I've got one more substantive question. From your research and experience, what are some of the best examples or case studies of city leaders who have led successfully during a crisis? Why and what was successful about their leadership and decision making?
Yeah. Well, the obvious one that comes to mind would be Rudy Giuliani and 9/11, putting aside kind of the politics of today and everything, but right, which was omnipresent, confident, empathetic, and knowledgeable, right? And you can't be a leader in crisis if you're not delivering the services your community needs. So it's a combination of rhetoric and symbolism and operational excellence. And so, because people will give you the benefit of the doubt when you're trying to inspire them, but you'll lose that if you're not delivering. Conversely, by the way, maybe I'll close with this. I think the day-to-day operations of government in a non-crisis mode, where citizens have the confidence that this is a government that is performing for me, those day-to-day acts build up the reservoir of trust that allows the mayor to call aspirationally for a better city in the future, or aspirationally to change your behaviors today. And so I would say that leading with competence, painting a picture that people can identify with, and most of all, empathy combined with operational excellence, I think would be the answer that all of us would aspire to produce.
Thank you. And just one more quick question, hopefully. We've been asked how others can order your books online and where they can find you potentially on social media if they'd like to follow you and see the other work that you're doing.
Oh, shucks. I'm so embarrassed to answer that question. So the book on the right will be out shortly. The book on the left, New City OS, is available from Amazon. It'll probably take you 20 minutes to read it, and it's cheap. And I don't make any money off of it, so I can promote it. GoldsmithOnGov is the Twitter handle, and there's a lot of examples of innovation. Up on the right on the slide, it says Data Smart City Solutions. That's the Harvard website that has a large inventory of innovations and a large inventory of kind of how to use data to innovatively address city government. And you can find me there as well. I'm a fan of local officials and happy to respond to anybody I could be of assistance to. And I appreciate your courtesy.
All right. Again, thank you to Professor Goldsmith for sharing this message and dialogue with our members about leadership in a time of crisis. Now more than ever, these skills and tools are critical as we all navigate this unprecedented pandemic together. After the webinar, we will email today's PowerPoint to all participants so you're all aware. In addition, as has been the case with our other webinars on COVID-19, this will be posted in multiple formats for you to review or share on our coronavirus resource page at www.mml.org. A few other resources of note. You may also have seen that each Monday at noon, we've been conducting our traditional Monday Morning Live as a new working from home series with our lobbying team. You can connect with that on our Facebook page. And coming up tomorrow at noon, we're hosting another webinar to provide you with information on the governor's new FOIA executive order to help you understand how to handle FOIA requests under the relaxed rules, including suggestions for best practices. Stay tuned for more information and other important webinar topics as we navigate these uncharted waters together. Thank you all, and that concludes our session for today.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.